I want to kind of go beyond the like personal happiness, personal growth version of gratitude, which is important. Mm-hmm. I want to really look at how gratitude serves the larger good, and how it offers us a pathway to sufficiency, to solidarity, and to that connection that furthers our work, furthers the work of people who might be looked upon as, you know, living in an oppressed place or doing really, really hard work. So I'm really interested in talking with people who see gratitude as sort of a core ground that I've been talking about for doing good work in the world, for being a part of the Great Turning.
Hi, welcome. My name is Duncan Autry, and this is Fractal Friends. This podcast is a place to explore our self-similarity across our diversity. We all have a role to play in the whole, and the purpose of this show is to interview people with interesting perspectives on the world and see what we can learn from each other. The guest for today's episode is Barbara Ford. Barbara has been an activist, a therapist, a facilitator, a singer, and an artist. She is also a self-identified late bloomer, and she is really awesome. In this conversation, we talk about what can we do during the Great Turning that we are experiencing right now. We talk about what it means to live in a culture of disassociation. And we talk about how we can be empowered by radical gratitude. I hope you enjoy this episode and this conversation with Barbara Ford.
Barbara, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today. You have led a life of doing a lot of work that's in trying to be of service to the world. And I just want to know if you just want to just speak a little bit to some of the work you've been doing recently and some of the work you've done, some of the things that you've been really excited about.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. So I find myself sort of at a time in my life right now where I'm getting to weave together different threads from different parts of my life into some work that combines it all. And it's quite a gift to me, actually, to have that opportunity. So I'm an artist. I've done some visual art. I'm a singer and a songwriter, relatively late to the game in that, but enjoying that. And I've been doing climate activism for about the last 15 years, starting in a faith communities and now working with 350.org, an affiliate in Portland, Oregon. So I'm combining my own kind of spiritual work with this activism and with the arts. And also I lead workshops based on the work of Joanna Macy. I've studied and worked with her for over a decade now for faith groups and activist groups and others on sort of how to stay present to the world while the world is going to hell in a handbasket. The hard work, the heart work and the hard work of working, staying in community and staying present to offer your gifts to the world. So everything that I do is kind of a convergence of all of those ideas right now. So I have a few projects going on related to those things.
So there's this like state that the world's in right now that, you know, I think kind of across the board, people are paying attention to, a lot of concern in lots of different directions. Some people, and I don't know if this is actually Joanna Macy's term, but they talk about the idea of the Great Turning.
Yes.
Can you talk a little bit about that concept and what that's about? And
Yeah. So Joanna will say that she didn't coin this term, but it's something that she uses and that many other people do. And essentially she's talking about, and we are talking about this time, it's a time of transition from the industrial growth society, which started during, you know, the industrial development times. And it's been a society of where economic growth is kind of the goal, and industrialization has been part of, you know, what drives our economy. And industrial growth is based on the premise that the economy can grow endlessly, which is impossible. And Joanna, being a systems theorist, will tell you, and anybody else will tell you, that you can't grow endlessly. There has to be corrections and changes that happen. The Industrial Growth Society is also based on a culture of consumerism and really a culture of dissociation. So anything that keeps people buying things, that keeps people kind of obedient to this culture of that's based on profit, would then we by necessity have to sort of shut down our other urges for connection and for community and power from coming from within our smaller communities, from the grassroots, because the industrial growth society depends on power coming from above. So the great turning time is this time that we're in right now, where we're kind of hitting ahead with industrial growth society. We're hitting a lot of ecological markers that really can't sustain our world. Culturally, we're dealing with endless wars, and we're dealing with the ongoing and iterations of oppression, racism, classism, and our culture, Western culture, is kind of falling apart at this point in time. At the same time that this culture is falling apart, there's also these beautiful new ways, new and the revitalization of old ways that are sustainable, that aren't dependent on endless growth, that are based in justice. And so this great turning time is this coexistence of the difficulties of the end of an industrial growth society, with all of its pains, with all of the oppressions, with all of the efforts by the powers that be to keep people in their place and to sustain their power in the face of waning power that is inevitable, really. And also the beauty and strength and wisdom and creativity of a culture that is emerging, that is about community, about groundedness, about justice, about sustainability, about faith, about reconnecting, about, you know, reclaiming our relationships and our belonging in the world. So it's sort of a time of tumult. It's a time of hope. It's a time of great difficulty. And it's sort of a new era of our culture at this point in time.
I know that sometimes it's also referred to as the time of the great unraveling,
yes,
right? Yeah, and it's interesting how sort of in this idea of the great turning, there's this encouragement for us to notice that some things are not going to keep working the way they're working now, because they're not working. But if we pay attention, we can see that there's all these other things coming around that are going to be there to hold us, you know, on this other side. And when we aren't able to recognize that, when we aren't able to sort of recognize that we maybe do have the capacity to, again, like learn from our old traditions, but also sort of build the new tools that we're going to need to sort of move forwards and sustainably, that's where there's like this moment of desperation happens. It's like, it's sometimes it's really hard to see that there might be a next chance, right? Like,
right,
you know, and I think there's a certain value of sort of, and we can't take that for granted either, I guess, you know? And so there's this kind of effort or this work that we're all kind of being called to do to sort of shepherd through this time. I guess, what are some of the things that you sort of encourage people, or what are the things you would point us to as we're trying to understand this time? Like, what are some of the things that you see that you're really inspired by?
Right. Well, first I'd like to address sort of the whole great unraveling, great turning thing.
Yeah.
Because the reality is we're all living in three different stories right now. The great turning is, well, I'm going to start with one. The basic story that we're listening, that we're getting in mainstream media, is the business as usual story. This is just the way it is. Capitalism is the best way to go. Fossil fuels are here and we got to use them up because they're there and there's profit to be made and we need it and there's no other solutions. That's sort of business as usual. And we are all embedded, whether we want to be or not, we're all embedded in the business as usual story. You know, I took a plane down to the Bay Area from Portland to get here. I'm embedded in the business as usual story. And there's lots of other choices that we each make, that we have to make, you know, in the use of our energy, or in, you know, where we can buy our food, whatever. It's just a part of life that we can't completely escape, or very few of us can completely escape the business as usual story. The great unraveling is the story of we're not going to make it. Everything is falling apart. Ocean acidification, the loss of all life, the species, the climate is changing. The police state is just overwhelming the Great Unraveling story. We're all living in the Great Unraveling story as well. The Great Turning story is thus, yes, and yes, there's all these things are happening, and other creative endeavors, brilliance and heart is creating these new ways of being. And so the question that I hold is not like what's true, because it's all true, but where do I want to put my energy? What story do I want to put my energy into? Because I could sit in the business as usual story and be utterly in denial and just say, that's the deal. Or I could sit in the Great Unraveling story and just say, there's no use in doing anything because we're all going to die. But I can also, or I can sit in the Great Turning, which is, I don't know what's going to happen exactly, but I'm choosing to put my energy into a place of being a part of whatever kindness, whatever creativity, whatever art, whatever justice, whatever support of people who are doing good work in the world, that's where I'm going to put my energy. Mm. So I'm going to choose to put my energy into this Great turning story, not out of denial about anything else, totally acknowledging that this other piece is happening, but also it's a humble place, because we actually don't know. You can say you know what's going to happen, but we really don't know what's going to happen. Change happens in unexpected ways. There's things that have happened nobody would predict. Like, for example, gay marriage. Now, gay marriage isn't, I'm a lesbian. Gay marriage isn't like, I don't aspire to be married, but it's a huge deal in this culture. And that I would not have known 10 years ago that it would have taken the trajectory. Nobody could have really predicted that it would have taken the trajectory it did.
Yeah.
So when people say they know exactly what's going to happen, none of us know exactly what's going to happen. So we put our energy, those of us who choose to, into being the people that we want to be and not turning away.
Yeah.
We don't turn away from the pain, but we also put our energy into being, who shall I be no matter what happens?
Mm-hmm. I really want to flag that the first step in that is the recognition of not knowing.
Yes.
Right? Like, because the other ones kind of have this assertion, mm-hmm. the other stories have this assertion of, I know that this is the way things are,
right.
and that's not changing, or that mm-hmm. I know that it's going to heck, and so I'm just going to let it unravel, whatever.
Yeah.
But as soon as you say, I don't know what's going to happen, mm-hmm. then that creates the space for what are the choices I want to make, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
we could all of a sudden make choices as soon as we recognize that we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
There's this song that I really like that I'm just actually learning how to play right now. And it's it has this line. It says, like, everybody sees a small part of everything and nothing. Mm-hmm. And when you finally know that you can't know, step forward.
Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful.
I'll play it for you before you leave.
Okay.
Yeah, I just really appreciate that there's something each time you're like, we can't know what's going to happen. And then therefore we're allowed to lean into the
right.
good work, right?
Yeah. So when we were talking before, I mentioned that I'm studying improvisational singing.
Mm-hmm.
So improvisational singing is all about opening your mouth and letting sound out without knowing ahead of time really what's going to come out.
Yeah.
And it's like a practice. It's like a practice of, I'm going to sing. I'm going to trust that something will come out. It may or may not be the most beautiful thing in the world, but I will let my body be a vessel for what wants to be released or, sung out into the world. And when you talk about hope, I think of hope as like a song. It's not something that you own. It's not something you have. There's no certainty about an outcome. Hope is not the same thing as optimism. Hope is something that you enact, that you choose. And hope, for me, I've said to people, hope is like a song. It isn't really itself until it's let out into the air and you hear it. It's written down, but you don't know what the song actually is. Most of us don't know what the song actually is until we hear it. And so this is something that we make a choice to be a part of, this time. Like, here we are. And in many ways, I think it's many of us are privileged to be a part of choosing justice, of choosing to stand in, you know, in the face of the storm and decide. And it's also a challenge, like, who are we? Who shall we be? What gifts do I have to bring? Because we can't all bring the same gift. So it's a challenge for us to grow and to discover our own fierceness and our own creativity in ways that we may never have known if we weren't willing to step into this place and if we weren't born into this place. Mm. You know, we, as Joanna said, if we could be utterly reassured that everything was going to be okay, would we know our greatest courage and creativity? Maybe not. You know, so it's an opportunity. It's a, you know, I don't want to say it's a gift because oppression is not a gift, but it's an opportunity for those of us who are capable and willing and interested in being a part of this great turning. You know, how do we make our choices to be, to offer ourselves to the world?
Yeah. You know? There's this idea that you mentioned in some of your writings that one of the things that's happening in our current culture is this, that it depends on us having this feeling of inadequacy, right? Yeah. Like, and so there's also, you know, as long as we feel like we're not good enough, and this is actually something I've been riffing on a lot in my mm-hmm. own sort of blogging and just thinking lately, just there really is that strong push for us to feel like we're not good enough. And,
yeah.
and that's part of what limits us from being able to, find that voice, that to even have the courage to improvise or to let something happen. The first barrier we have to overcome is the feeling that I can't do it. I'm not good enough. I'm not right.
Yeah. And that's a story. You know, a lot of us get those stories in our families, you mm-hmm. know, and they're stories. There's stories that we've heard that, you know, have worn a groove in our brain or whatever way you want to think about it. But it's also a cultural story because capitalist culture, consumer culture, essentially the story is you need this thing to feel good about yourself. You need this thing to feel good about your body. You really have to purchase things in order to make yourself, make people notice you and like you. You know, it's part of our culture. Inadequacy is part of the consumer culture story.
Mm-hmm.
Incapacity is part of the capitalist consumer story. So, and it's a way of separating ourselves from our inner world. So I sort of see this culture right now, I call it the culture of dissociation. And it's dissociation on every level. It's dissociation from our hearts, our bodies, our creativity within ourselves, our sense of our own capacity, our connection to the land, our connection to food, our connection to our communities, our connection to our political systems, all the way up to our connection to the cosmos on all levels. So any work that allows us to reconnect, as Joanna calls some of the work that reconnects, or to, for me, the word belonging, to give a sense of belonging in the world, because to me that's a more poignant experience and a more emotional experience. Reconnection feels a little more heady to me. But to actually promote a sense of belonging to my heart, to my body, to my creative energy, to the land, to the food, to my community, to my political system. And really, and belonging has a, you know, it's a double-edged sword. You know, there's problems with belonging to your culture. You know, white privilege is one of those problems, for example, of, oh, I belong to that. Darn. You know, it's like, I don't really like that. And yet I have to own that as part of my, and who am I going to be now that I know that?
Right. Cause, and also belonging can sometimes create that sense of other, right? Like,
right.
you know, if we're this team and that's that team.
Right.
And it's hard sometimes if we're really identified with who we belong to, it's hard to see, oh, we also belong to them too. Like, you
yeah.
know, like the bigger picture, right?
Exactly.
As you talked about those scales.
Yeah.
yeah.
So that, that's a part of our job too, is to, figure out where we belong and who we are. Like in a permaculture garden, for example, every being in that garden has a job. They have a gift that they bring and it's not the same job. They're not supposed to be the same job. And so each one of us, I believe, is kind of, it's a similar situation. We are born into this world with particular gifts, or we develop them. I think we're born with tendencies, is my feeling. And we have a story to tell. And we are here to enact those gifts. I was just talking to somebody this morning who's an organizer, and she was talking about policy. And I said, you know, I sit in meetings where people talk about climate policy. I am not a policy wonk. That's not my gift. But I can sit and sort of have a big view of, like, how does this affect people in this group to know this piece of news? What's the story we can tell around this that will allow people to feel like they can come into to participating in some way that will be supportive, whether it's through art or music, or what's some way that we can support each other through this? That's my particular gift. I dissociate in front of, like, spreadsheets and policy wonkitude like crazy, but that's okay because I'm holding this other piece.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. We can't have a monoculture of activism, just like we can't have a monoculture of agriculture. We all have different gifts, so, and we all have to learn how to honor that for ourselves and for each other.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to transition a little bit to talking about your Radical Gratitude Project, this one that you're, mm-hmm. you're starting now. And sort of as a way of making this transition, I want to sort of capture, I know you've heard of David Temple Rast, the monk, the Benedictine mm-hmm. monk, and he's part of the Network for Grateful Living, and or the director, I guess. Mm-hmm. And when we're talking about this idea of inadequacy, he tells this story about how gratitude, there's like gratitude where we're just thankful for things.
Yeah.
And when we have enough things in our life, and we're like thankful, you know, grateful, and it kind of fills up like this vessel that we have like in our heart.
Mm-hmm.
And that if we allow the vessel to get full and start overflowing, then we enter the state that's like almost of thanksgiving, this sort of just blissful state.
Mm-hmm.
But that what happens in our society, he explains, is that once we get like almost full, the reaction of society is to be like, well, let me make the container a little bigger for you so you can fit more in there.
Mm.
So it's like, here's a new iPhone. Like, you're grateful for like all the things you have, or like, here's mm-hmm. something new that you don't have yet. So you're like, oh, great. I have space to sort of get more things. And so this sort of culture of like getting more and more and more allows us to sort of never get to that state of like pure thanksgiving, because we don't actually get to overflow, right? Because that the vessel in our hearts is always sort of growing so that society can just feed us more things to put into it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like, it's kind of responding to the story of, it's sort of an inverse of the not enough thing, because it's like if you make more room because there's more things you're supposed to need or more things you're supposed to want. So yeah, I hear what you're saying about that, that there's a story, that's consumer culture, the voice of consumer culture, saying, oh, you want this thing though too, don't you? Mm-hmm. To really be happy, you can, if you had the latest technology this year. And that, yeah, that interferes with that sense of sufficiency in a big way. And that's part of, none of us are immune. I mean, many people are a little more immune than others, but none of us are immune to hearing, you know, and some of it is like, well, I have to have that organic kale, you know, versus, or, you know, it's only if it's from my own garden. You know, it's like there's these stories we tell ourselves about food and about possessions and about housing and friendships and all kinds of things. Like, what's enough?
Yeah, there's this phenomena that I notice here in Berkeley sometimes, what I would call a sort of like fundamentalist hippies, you know, they sort of like, well, you're not doing it seriously as much as I'm doing it. And this is, I mean, it can even be a competition, right? There's always, lots of different directions. We can always be trying to show that we have more, or as soon as we have sort of get into that comparative place, which I guess is like part of why this is why that if it's so important to start finding that gratitude or that sort of sense of sufficiency in each mm-hmm. moment.
Yeah.
Right? Like, can you talk a little bit about sort of what your sort of experience is with gratitude and why you think it's such an important thing for us?
So I started really thinking about gratitude through Joanna Macy's work particularly. And she's called it different things as the work that reconnects or active hope, used to be called despair and empowerment work. And she found when she was first doing this work, like several decades ago, she would kind of go for the despair part, you know, the grief and everything. And people just kind of got lost, and then they shut down. And so one of the things that she decided to do was, like, start in gratitude, which is what happens, which is what is true in most indigenous cultures, by the way. This isn't, like, brand new material here. No,
this isn't a new idea.
This isn't a new idea. None of these are new ideas, actually. I'm just going to say, I don't like, there's no copyright Barbara Ford or Joanna Macy or anything on any of this. There's whole cultures that are based on the idea that you always start in gratitude. Mm-hmm. Many of which have maintained that stance through, you know, decimation of their culture and through, you know, Holocaust and a bunch of other things. So it's got to kind of have some lasting value. But our culture, this Western white American culture, is losing touch with gratitude, or it pays it, you know, sort of superficial homage without really getting that it's a place we need to live in order to be the ground that we stand on, to hold us through whatever else goes on. And that's the piece, is like, I think David Steindl-Rast said, you can't be grateful for everything, but you can be grateful at any time. Mm-hmm. That in the face of struggle, you can be grateful for the ones who were there with you in the struggle. You can be grateful for the grass underneath your feet. You can be grateful for the water that you get to drink. You can be grateful for the sun that's still shining. And that is something that, it's not a Pollyanna kind of, oh, at least this. It's not that. It really is, I am here. I am full. I am with the world. I am present in the storm. I am willing to be fully present because I am held by the ground, the sky, my friends, whatever it is. I'm held here, and I'm grateful for that holding. And I have the capacity to hold this other being with me. And it's a form of ongoing mindfulness practice, this gratitude work. It's a way, it's kind of what feeds us, it's what holds us through anything. And it also is, along with the staying present to our difficult feelings, our pain, our grief, our anger, reminds us that we're not separate. That gratitude reminds us that we are not separate. It reminds us that we are connected, that we are belonging in the world, that we are a part of a larger body of earth that that we can maintain this relationship with and be with more fully on an ongoing basis.
Hello, you're listening to Fractal Friends. If you're enjoying this show, I would really love it if you subscribe to the podcast at iTunes. And you also can visit our website at fractalfriends.us.
I feel like I just understood something here. Like, because I've heard this idea that gratitude connects us with belonging, but there's something really powerful about that, because gratitude is a relational experience.
Yes.
Right? Like, I mean, even if it's some other part of myself, even if it's some aspect of myself that's different than the self that's being grateful for it, like, mm-hmm. it's a relational experience. If I'm being grateful for the bird chirping, or the trees, or the sun, then I'm recognizing my connection with those things.
Right.
Or I'm being grateful for the people around me, or the people that the loved ones, or the lessons that I'm getting learned. It's a relational experience.
Right. Yeah, it is. And I'll give a personal example.
Sure.
About 3 years ago, my best friend Sophie went into the hospital and with breathing problems, and it turned into a 3-month ordeal of several near-death experiences and a heart-lung bypass machine and a medical coma for a month, and it was quite traumatic for all of us. She was she was in the coma. She didn't experience a lot of this, but her partner, who was also a dear friend, and I and a couple of other people kind of were in the hospital daily, kind of managing this whole situation. I was there to sort of help her partner out, who had MS and, you know, was very capable and everything, but just needed a lot of support because stress wasn't good for her. And so I was there and witnessed, you know, several emergencies and making decisions. And, you know, there were some questions several times whether she's going to be alive. And at one point, as we'd gotten I think she hadn't come out of the medical coma, I went downstairs, as you have, you know, because you still have to eat. And my job was to feed her partner. And I went downstairs to the hospital, and it happened to be a hospital that had really good food. And I went, and that day they had somebody who was making these beautiful fresh stir-fried vegetable meals for people. And I remember just standing there after something had happened with a doctor, or we just gotten some news or something, and just so grateful that this hospital had a system and a person who was willing to make this beautiful plate of food that I could then take up to my friend who was waiting to see her for a partner who was going to be alive or not. And I'm getting all verklempt just thinking about it still. And it was that capacity to be present in the moment of like, oh, what a beautiful plate of food. And I started crying because I was not out of grief, but out of gratefulness that this moment could happen and that I could look at all the people. Eventually I could see everybody in the hospital who was conspiring to help those of us who were in this position, you know, because everybody in the hospital was in some kind of painful position. And so notice the hands of the nurse as they were taking care of my friend, or the way the people were so kind to her partner, or the way the doctor, you know, it was like, we were lucky. We had really good medical care. And I had this plate of food was like the symbol for me of being grateful in the midst of huge pain and fear, you know. And I've had that repeatedly happen to me in the face of just being grateful that I even care. Like I have a heart that cares when I see something horrible going on. Or I'm grateful that there are people who are willing to document some of the greatest atrocities. There are people out there doing this work of documenting it so it won't be forgotten or missed. It's like it's a gratitude isn't always a happy place, but it is a place of deep, deep resonance of connection. And it holds me, and it can hold many people. And I've been talking to people for the last week about who are on the front lines of doing very intense social justice work, who speak of gratitude as the core that holds them in whatever it is that they're embarking on, their good work.
First, just want to say that just how... First of all, thank you for sharing that. And then something about the beauty of how food is just such a great anchor, right? Because, you know, it really shows us how we're connected to everything, right? You know, not only is food just soil and light.
Mm-hmm. And nourishment and love and care and beauty.
Exactly,
and
but all the hands that it takes to get that to us.
Yeah, like they had to have a program, like... People need good food, you know, they had to know that that was necessary, and it wasn't just about nutrition, it was about, you know, aesthetics and taste, and, you know, and then there are the people who made it. It was just, you know, just like I was sitting there kind of reeling at the moment with what I saw as a conspiracy of love and care for the people who were struggling, so.
In your work, you talk about different elements of gratitude, or radical gratitude, as you call it. And I just want to sort of capture some of them because I think they're really rich. There's this aspect that there's one that we've been talking about, that it's enduring and it's always available to us in all the different kinds of circumstances. And there's also this like the aspect of the expressive part. This is the part that we're familiar with, right? That like don't forget to say your please and thank yous, you know. but there's also just the acknowledgement in ourselves and so forth. One of the things you talk about is the idea of gratitude as being empowering. And that intuitively makes sense to me. But it also seems like you could also imagine, like, why is gratitude empowering and is not, like, a sign of, I don't know, weakness? I don't know if you know what I mean. Like, you know, because if I'm like, oh, I'm grateful for this thing that I'm getting, that I needed. How is it that I'm empowered by gratitude? Can you talk about that a little bit?
You know, and it's something I'm still learning about.
Yeah.
So one of the reasons I want to do this project is because I want to get stories from people and learn and expand this question. It's something I'm very curious about. But for me, Part of it has to do with that gratitude as a ground of support, mm-hmm. so that we sense ourselves supporting, being supported by gratitude, which then releases us into a greater sense of sufficiency,
right.
our own capacity, because we can be grateful for anything. We can be grateful for not knowing, and that releases us into like our curiosity and our creativity to explore things, for example. That's one form of power.
Mm-hmm.
Our gratitude to be connected to other beings who are working together. Like, we aren't, you know, we don't all have to be holed up trying to fix the world by ourselves. We can't fix the world by ourselves. You know, people are always saying, I was just talking to a philosopher, writer named Kathleen Dean Moore, who's, you should look for her books. And she said, people come to me and they say, what can I do by myself? And she says, stop being by yourself. That's what you can do.
That's great.
So, stop trying to do it by yourself.
What?
So this empowerment of gratitude is about the relational aspect, that you can be grateful for the gifts that other people have to offer. You can be grateful for how your particular gift fits into the permaculture, or however you want to frame it, of offerings, of strength, of power, of creativity. And I think that it serves, its empowerment comes a bit from all these other qualities that I'm talking about, it that are essentially qualities of connection, qualities of presence and connection. One story I'll tell comes from one of my colleagues, John Seed, who's in Australia. And he was part of he started the Rainforest Information Center in Australia, and he was doing all kinds of advocacy and work on behalf of the rainforests, which were being devastated, essentially cut down. And he talks about this time where he's standing between the forest and the bulldozers set to turn, to essentially come shut, you know, cut down all the trees. Now, this also ties into the ecological aspect, I think, of qualities of gratitude. And he said, I was standing there and I was with my people and I realized I am not me, John Seed, protecting the rainforest. I am the part of the rainforest that has been elected to protect itself, that has been called to protect itself, seeing himself as part of a larger body of earth, and that he had the capacity and the power and the strength, thus anointed by him by being a part of this larger whole, to use his power to do what he could to end or stop the destruction. Mm. So that's a convergence of the ecological mind, heart, set, and empowerment right there. And I'm sort of playing with the word empowerment because I've had people mention to me, like, it sounds like something that people give to each other. And I'm not talking about like being gifted with empowerment. I'm sort of like claiming, and maybe I'll come up with another word, hopefully an E word, because they all begin with E. that sort of really speaks to that that claiming of one's own journey, that claiming of one's own power, that claiming of one's own soul gift of sorts.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and this also connects to one of the, you mentioned earlier, the concepts that Joanna Macy works with, and I think you also do workshops around, mm-hmm. about despair and empowerment, right? Like that's, there's kind of two sides of this coin. So, I mean, it's coming from that sense of empowerment.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
yeah. And it's all about connection or belonging for
right.
me. That's my, like I talked about, so anything that's an antidote to separation is an antidote to what's happening in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that anything that reconnects us to our power, to our creativity, to our heart, to our capacity to be together. I mean, I was just talking to somebody who does work with conflict resolution in groups, community groups and stuff. That is, you know, such beautiful work because it's so important. We're all learning to work with each other in ways that we really haven't. We've tried, you know, but like, we're really going to have to get good at this. Somebody's going to have to get good at this. We don't all have to be equally good, but somebody's got to lead the way with this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an empowering quality too.
Yeah.
For people to be able to hold their own, to know who they are, to know what gifts they have to bring, to work in community, knowing that, not having to be the same as everybody else, that you know, that's not a part of our culture. That's not what we're encouraged to do. But that's what the work that we have to do.
Yeah.
We all have to find some way to do that.
Totally. Yeah, I'm always fond of saying that there's lots of expertise that we need. There's lots of skills, lots of things people need to learn. But one of the things that the world needs most right now is just the ability to talk to each other.
Right.
And to basically embrace our diversity that we have and use that as a stepping off point of connectedness. And so I like how it keeps coming back to belonging. I appreciate that.
And speaking our truth and listening to each other's truth.
Mm.
One of the things that some of the practices we do are just about speaking people. It's very simple practices of, you know, just completing a sentence, saying something about something that brings them joy, for example. And one person's listening in silence, but, you know, being present, being fully present to the person as they speak. And the person is given a fair amount of time to speak without interruption. Well, A, that almost never happens in anybody's life. To be listened to without interruption. And, you know, our tendency is like, oh, yeah, I love hummingbirds too, or whatever it is. You know, you want to insert yourself. But when you back off and you're fully present in a way, it's a gift to both the witness and the person who's being witnessed to make that space of, you know, to be able to fully listen without thinking of the next thing you're going to say, something to be grateful for, to be able to be listened to without being interrupted, to be heard, to speak your truth. To allow to go deeper, some people don't know at the top of their tongues, and it takes them verbally, they need to process, and they'll say things maybe they didn't even know were going to come out.
Yeah.
That kind of spaciousness. And I want to say something about the despair piece, because in the work that we do, we're exploring the feelings that come up when we're thinking about the sad or horrible or unjust things that are happening in the world. Sadness, anger, fear, confusion, or just sort of numbness that can happen. You know, that those feelings are coming up because there's a part of us that we know that knows we're not separate. The fact that I can cry when I'm seeing pictures, video of those Syrian refugees washing up on the beaches on the Isle of Lesbos. Why else would I be crying? Because I am not separate from them. I am not separate from them. And so my heart knows that, even though my head may be sometimes in a different place at times, my heart knows that there is no separation and that there's no private salvation and that we're all in this together. And the word compassion comes from the words that mean to suffer with. Compassion, to suffer with. And so compassion is one of the most highly venerated practices in any spiritual tradition, along with gratitude. You know, those two things are reminders to us of our belonging to each other and to the world.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you. That really, I feel like, ties so many threads together. Thank you. You just said just a moment ago that there's all these spiritual traditions that have this idea of compassion and gratitude and. There is this piece that sort of, there is something kind of universal about gratitude. And I guess that's probably part of why you're really excited about collecting stories of people's experiences with gratitude. Because it does cut across class, religion,
political viewpoints.
Political viewpoints. Exactly. Gratitude is something that we all can. It's a meeting point, right?
Right.
So can you just talk a little bit? One of your goals for this project is to meet people and gather stories around gratitude.
Right.
Yeah.
And specifically, I want to kind of go beyond the like personal happiness, personal growth version of gratitude, which is important. I want to really look at how gratitude serves the larger good and how it offers us a pathway to sufficiency, to solidarity, and to that connection that furthers our work, furthers the work of people who might be looked upon as, you know, living in an oppressed place or doing really, really hard work. So my particular interest right now, most of my connection is sort of in the environmental justice world. So I've been talking with people in the indigenous activist world and people who are doing environmental justice work. But I'm really interested in talking with people who see gratitude as sort of a core ground that I've been talking about for doing good work in the world, for being a part of the Great Turning. Mm-hmm. So that would include activists, that would include theologians, that would include artists, that would include teachers, that would include healers, a bunch of different ways. You know, if their intention is to sort of bring that good work into the world, how does gratitude serve it? Because I don't want it to be the commodified version of gratitude. In fact, I probably won't even use the word gratitude much in the conversations, because gratitude has sort of become like the word sustainability or, you know, a bunch of other things that have gotten kind of commercialized or commodified in some ways. I really want to get down to sort of a core, you know, how does your feeling of connection to the gladness or the goodness of the world and yourself, how does that support you? Or how does your community do gratitude practices? What holds you? And I'm also collecting practices, so personal and community collective practices of gratitude and how that serves movements and communities. And I hope to sort of gather this together in some format. I don't know if it's going to be a website or a book or something, but a place where people can come and you know, gather more information about these ideas, maybe offer up their own practices, maybe a back and forth kind of experience to grow the idea and the focus on how this can serve justice and serve the healing of our world.
Yeah. What are some traditions or practices around gratitude in your life?
I have some silly ones. I have some, I actually grew up in the Unitarian world. I was born and raised Unitarian. And, you know, we didn't have a lot of ritual when I was growing up. But certainly I have a regular practice of, you know, when I eat. Certainly I don't necessarily do like a big grace or anything. I do that in community sometimes. But I always take a moment before I eat to be grateful for the food and all that brought the food to me. I was in a retreat with Thich Nhat Hanh several years ago with my daughter, and he spoke, he has the interbeing thing, and he gave this wonderful little speech. He says, in the morning, when you have your toast, he said, just look at the toast and know that the toast is the wheat and the water and the rain and the farmer and the truck that transported it, as he talks about these. And he sort of goes on this long list of what the toast can be. And he says, so just look at your toast as your ambassador to the universe. So I might not be totally there every time I'm at a meal, but I try to sort of embody some version of gratitude for that. One other thing that I've been doing most recently, which is a new exploration, is I have had a lot of injuries, physical injuries in my life, and very tight in my hips and legs. And it's sort of been like, oh, my hips, oh, my hamstrings are so tight. And I've started a new yoga practice. It's a very gentle practice, very loving, gentle practice. I found a great yoga place in Portland to go to. And my new practice has been, when I feel my hamstrings or my hips holding me tight, I thank them for trying so hard to support me. You know, it's like, it doesn't really work so well for me, but I thank you for trying, because they got that way somehow, you know, through my injury years and years ago, whatever. All my body is trying to do is to hold me together. And so while I'm at the same time trying to help it release a little bit, I'm also sort of thanking it for trying so hard. Mm-hmm. Maybe don't have to try so hard now, but...
Yeah.
I have, do we have time for one more
sure.
little story?
Yeah.
Okay. So one of my teachers and friends is Bill Plotkin, who's written the book Nature and the Human Soul, Soulcraft, and he runs programs through the Animus Institute in Durango, Colorado. One of the gifts he gave me was he reframed the idea of the inner critic for me. He calls them loyal soldiers. This is related to the yoga thing. And he said, you know, he tells a story of Japanese soldiers in World War II who are lost out on islands in the Pacific for years after the war is over. And they're being soldiers the whole time. They're just like they're in the war still because they got lost during the war. And then as they were slowly kind of found and reintegrated, they needed to be told over and over again, the war is over. Thank you for your service. Let's find you a new job. And because they kind of were in this war mode, you know, and so they had to be repeatedly told, the war is over. Thank you for your service. We'll find you a new job. So when those voices come into our head that saying you're not good enough, or you don't have enough strength, or you can't possibly write that book, it's some old voice from somebody in your past that gave you that voice. And you can turn to it and say, as an adult, the war is over. Thank you for your attempt to be at service. Let's find you a new job. And it's a way to sort of disarm this voice so that it's still there. I just talked to an eminent person who says, I hear that voice all the time, and she still does things. It's a way to release its power of restriction on us. And so it's offering gratitude to the part of us that's self-critical. That's particularly radical, I think.
Yeah.
Without allowing it to take power, but just saying, thank you for trying so hard to try to save me from shame or embarrassment or whatever it is that happened when I was 3 years old, when I first heard my mother say this thing. Thank you very much. The war is over. And so that's another piece of practice that I do regularly, because I'm not immune from, oh, should you really do that? Who are you to start this big project? Who are you to ask so-and-so to be interviewed? You know, just like, there's no harm here. I'm going to just do it and see what happens.
Yeah. Well, it's really radical just to look at something that feels like it's not serving us, or that we kind of don't want to acknowledge. Mm-hmm. And instead of trying to suppress it or destroy it, just to hold it closer, right? And to say,
yeah,
thank you for being here and being concerned that I'm doing things right in this world. And that's really great motivation. Now you just relax for a second and we're going to get things done. But yeah, but also just in general, like, to be able to embrace the things that aren't serving us anymore, it's really beautiful. Yeah,
I was really grateful for that, mm-hmm. for that teaching in particular, because I have had other teachers say, we got to get rid of the inner critic. And I was like, I'm trying to re-educate people around that now, because it's like trying to cut off our leg, you know, in some ways. It's a way for us to denigrate, oh, I have this inner critic. It's terrible I have this inner critic. It's like, it's another way to cut ourselves down.
Yeah.
Which is just a part of the human condition,
totally.
You know, for most of us.
Yeah. There's a question that I enjoy asking everyone who comes onto the show. Mm-hmm. And I just, from your life experience as Barbara Ford, mm-hmm. What is something that you found in life that you would invite the rest of the world to pay attention to as they're trying to sort of make their lives better, world better?
Mm-hmm. Well, besides gratitude.
I'm
just going to be very specific.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so I think that we all need to sing more.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that knowing that maybe a third to a half of the people listening to this podcast will have a story in their head of, oh, I really can't sing, or I shouldn't sing, or I'd embarrass myself, or I was told when I was 5 I should be the one that pulls the curtain instead of singing in the chorus, or whatever it is. And to them I say, I hear what you're saying. I honor the grief and fear that you've had around your voice. But the world needs all of our voices, A. And B, there's a lot of scary stuff coming down the road that's a lot scarier than whether or not we can sing. So I would encourage us to practice with that fear by singing in community, and sort of practice so that we'll know when the scarier stuff comes along, we'll have some skills to be able to face the scary stuff, because we learn to sing through our fear.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much. That's a great answer. So Barbara, if people want to get in touch with you or find out the work you're doing, how can they find you?
Mm-hmm. I have a website, Barbara Ford, B-A-R-B-A-R-A, Ford, F-O-R-D, .net. And you can find me there. I'm probably going to be starting up a Radical Gratitude Facebook page at some point. I don't really have any other media up around that right now because I'm just getting started. But you can find me and contact me through my website.
Great. And if people have amazing stories about gratitude, they should reach out to you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time today. I'm really glad we got to meet each other this week.
Great synchronicity.
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Please visit fractalfriends.us to find out more about what Barbara's doing in the world. And as a way of saying goodbye, here's a song by Barbara Ford called Broken World.
Just a small part of this broken world.